Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, today in the program, we'll explore why it is that some of the greatest works of literature have been produced by writers in the grip of alcoholism. We'll speak with Olivia Lang. She's author of the new book, The Trip to Echo Spring.
And then we'll have Tom Daigle of the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance. He's going to join us to discuss how backcountry enthusiasts help preserve and protect the canyons of the Wasatch.
Yes, indeed. And finally, Cindy Chupac. She's the author of the book, The Longest Date. Yep, you've got it. The longest date turns out to be marriage, in fact. She'll talk to us about her new book. She's also a writer for Modern Family and Sex in the City. So she's got a lot of interesting perspectives on relationship. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Your daughter takes a fall on her bike, and you're not sure what's really going on with her aches and pains. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino at Intermountain Instacare. We gladly accept walk-in patients. No appointment needed. Our Instacare in Park City is located at 1665 Bonanza Drive. We have a new call-ahead number to reserve an arrival time. Call 435-649-7705. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, it's an addiction that cost writers like Ernest Hemingway, Raymond Carver, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Tennessee Williams, John Berryman, and John Cheever personal happiness, and it caused them to harm those who loved them. But how in the end did they create such great works of literature? Our first guest, Olivia Lang, examines the link between creativity and alcohol in her new book, The Trip to Echo Spring. She talks about these six extraordinary men and their great works that weave both through their own lives and their work. It's a tale of alcoholism and writing, really. Joining us to talk about her new book is Olivia Lang. Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Olivia.
Good morning, Lynn.
Well, it's nice to have you. And I guess my first question would be something like, you know, is it akin to saying that rock stars, you know, have addiction to drug issues? I mean, is it that common? I don't really know. I didn't know until I grabbed your book and started reading it, the connection between great writing and alcoholism.
It's terrifyingly common. And I mean, the list, I could have chosen dozens and dozens of different writers. The list includes people like William Faulkner, Jean Rhys. You know, there's just a great range of alcoholic writers. These six are some of the best that America has ever produced, and all of them suffered from alcoholism lifelong. So it was really this kind of hidden history that I wanted to get to grips with. I wanted to know what alcohol had done to them, but I also wanted to know what role alcohol plays in literature.
Well, I'm sure the relationship between writing and alcohol was different for each of these men, but I'm wondering, you know, which came first? Was it the brooding, creative mind that led them into alcoholism, or did the alcoholism come first? How did it kind of go, if you can generalize?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some general answers that one can make, and I think really the thing that I found, which I was surprised by, is that it seemed to me like the creativity and the alcoholism came from the same origin place. So it wasn't like the alcohol caused the creativity. They tended not to even write drunk most of the time. And it wasn't necessarily like the creativity caused the alcoholism, but more that these were guys who suffered from extreme anxiety, often depression, had genetic predispositions towards alcoholism, but also really found day-to-day life quite hard. So they were using drinking to self-medicate, to escape from that. But that also seemed to be where some of the origins of their creativity came from. So there's this kind of link, which at first alcohol seems like this wonderful thing that allows them to stop feeling so bad. Later on, it starts causing its own problems, and that's where it really starts impacting badly on their writing.
So, Olivia, are there certain types of creative people? Is that really the commonality to these writers, that they were creative and they had a predisposition? And is there a link not not necessarily between alcoholism and writing, but maybe creativity and alcoholism?
I wonder. I mean, during the course of the book, I spoke to all kinds of specialists. I spoke to psychiatrists. I spoke to neurobiologists. I went to AA meetings. And the bottom line seems to be nobody knows what causes alcoholism. Some of it is definitely genetic. But aside from that, we don't know. Some of it is to do with family experience. Some of it is to do with personality. And likewise, we don't really know what makes a person creative. So it's speculative answers. But what seemed to me to be very strong in these stories of people like, say, John Cheever or F. Scott Fitzgerald, is this kind of unhappiness that led them into the escapism of wanting to make up stories, make up fictions, but also, more dangerously, led them into this desire to start hitting the bottle and hitting it very hard.
Is there anything that you could that you learned when you researched them about their, I guess maybe their psychological makeup and their sensitivity? Because, you know, we sort of take it for granted that creative people are a little different, right? They are more sensitive. They engage with the world differently. And if they're intelligent and sensitive, there's a lot of stuff out there that could throw one into a path of trying to change their reality, their experience.
Absolutely. I think that's so true. And I think there's something else. Sensitivity is an interesting word, isn't it? Because it's not necessarily very manly. And these are guys who, I mean, if you think about Hemingway, there's nobody more manly and macho. And I think a lot of that is like the alcoholism becomes this pose. It becomes this way of sort of saying, I'm a tough guy. I don't have these feelings. He spends a lot of time when he writes about alcohol saying, I can take it. I can drink anyone under the table. I'm a terrific drinker. And I think that's a lot of machismo. And actually, it's being used to conceal this much more sensitive, much more wounded guy that's hidden away behind that macho facade.
Would you say, Olivia, that Ernest Hemingway is the one that we know most about? His plight I know most about. And I think maybe, I mean, one, he's buried in Sun Valley, which is near to us. And also, it seems like anywhere I go in the world, I run into some bar where Ernest, made famous by Ernest Hemingway getting sloshed there.
I think he pretty much drank in every bar in the world. Yeah, I think he's the one who won the Nobel Prize. He really is one of the great novelists of all time. And it was interesting dipping back into his work, which I read long ago and revisited while working on this book, and remembering just what an extraordinary writer he is, that something like For Whom the Bell Tolls is absolutely one of the greatest novels that has ever been written. So I think he is the one with a sort of huge reputation, but then Fitzgerald, Tennessee Williams, these are, you know, big American figures, really incredibly talented. And I think something like a play like Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or Streetcar Named Desire, that's absolutely one of the great texts of the 20th century.
Olivia, you said that these writers didn't generally write drunk, but they were alcoholics and their drinking informed their writing. Can you give us an example from your book of that?
Yeah, of course. Because the myth tends to be that they are writing drunk, that they're sitting by the typewriter sort of knocking back the brandy. And I know Scott Fitzgerald did do that sometimes. He wrote quite a lot of Tender as the Night while he was drinking. But he regretted that later. So what it tends to be is something more like waking up in the morning. This is true for both Tennessee Williams and Ernest Hemingway. Waking up in the morning, drinking the black coffee, sitting down very early, writing the pages, maybe having a swim later, and then that's when the drinking starts. And Hemingway says something amazing about that. He says, I just need to change the channel on it. I've been working all day and I need to slip into a different mode. I need to escape from the kind of stresses that writing's built up. That may be true, and later on it may be more of an excuse, though, as alcohol addiction starts taking over and he really doesn't have any choice about drinking or not.
I'm wondering now, I guess it's the point in the conversation where we bring you and your personal story of alcoholism and your family into why you wrote this book.
Yeah, so I grew up in an alcoholic family, and we had a really difficult period when I was around 8 to 10. It was really quite stressful, disordered, difficult times. And later on, at about, I guess, 17, I was studying English at school, and we read Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. We read Tennessee Williams' play. And I was immediately struck by it, of just, oh, my God, this is this is an alcoholic family. This is what I've just come from. And the whole thing about alcoholism is there's so much denial around it. People don't want to say it's happening. People keep it very secret. Mm-hmm. And that sort of infects the family who are around the alcoholic as well. So for me, finding this play that suddenly was saying, this is what it's like, this is what the dynamics are like, was very exciting. And I think from then on, I mean, that's almost 20 years ago, but from then on, I had it in the back of my mind that I really wanted to know more about what writers had to say about alcohol. And then gradually the penny dropped that they weren't just writing out of close observation. They were writing because they were alcoholics themselves. They knew what they were talking about. And so that then seemed to me like this fascinating story to get to grips with.
Our guest is Olivia Lang. She's the author of A Trip to Echo Spring. And I should say that the title of this book comes out of that play, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, excuse me, by Tennessee Williams. And maybe this is part of the denial and the secrecy, was that somewhere in the play it mentions how it's the trip actually to the liquor cabinet for some bourbon. And Echo Spring is a type of bourbon, apparently. And so this is the little trip. That was how they would describe going off for a drink, which is, you know, which is secretive. And I think any of us who've been around alcoholics see that denial and secrecy.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something about that phrase that I really liked, because it just sounds so lovely, doesn't it? Who wouldn't want to go to Echo Spring? It sounds gorgeous. And it made me think there's something symbolic happening when writers are drinking, when anyone's drinking. They're trying to get somewhere. And I kind of wanted to know what that somewhere was, what that place is.
Yeah.
And Olivia, where did the journey of alcoholism and creativity and the confluence of these different themes in their lives lead them? What was the end result?
The end result was not good. So out of the six writers I looked at, four carried on drinking, two managed to stop. So I look at the ones who drank themselves basically to death first. And those were suicides. John Berryman jumped off a bridge and killed himself. Ernest Hemingway, as we all know, shot himself in the head in his farmhouse. Both those men's fathers had also killed themselves, incidentally. Mm-hmm. So these are, you know, really tragic, wasteful, dark stories. Then Tennessee Williams choked to death on the lid of a packet of pills, which is, again, just so sad, in a hotel room in New York. And before these deaths, they were struggling to write, Tennessee Williams was struggling to put plays on, still working very hard, but really losing that kind of creativity, wrecked marriages, wrecked relationships with children. It's a familiar story of anyone who's encountered alcoholics. And while that's all true, I really didn't want the book to end there. I wanted to look at the recovery stories too. And so I ended with John Cheever and Raymond Carver, who incredibly bravely managed to go through the recovery process and to stop drinking and had these years of sobriety, which I think is nothing short of astonishing. Really very, very brave stuff.
So, Olivia, you had the opportunity to examine these famous creative writers and follow their personal journeys and their struggle with alcoholism. And obviously, you know, you were sort of looking at the people that stand out because of they are celebrities, right? I mean, they're part of our literary history. But alcoholism is something that normal people deal with every day. And I'm sure the way that it ended for, you know, the examples you just gave is very common.
Yeah, yeah.
And then not so common for those who you know, follow Cheever's example and are able to come to terms with it and defeat alcoholism.
Yeah, the AA meeting, I write about going to an AA meeting in the book because I really wanted to underline that point that, yeah, these are the extraordinary guys, but this is an ordinary tale. This is really something that happens all the time, and people are capable of making their lives horrendous, and people are also capable of these often very invisible acts of heroism, of managing to stop. And one of the things I found most touching was there was a man, you know, people bear witness in AA meetings, and there was a man who got up and he said, I've been sober 20 years and this is my sobriety anniversary and it seems amazing to me. My son has never seen me drunk. And I just thought, that's amazing that he, 20 years later, is still coming to AA in order to help other people. So that sense of fellowship is something I really admired. And I hope that this is a book that touches people who do drink or who have experienced drinking, because that's so much part of my story.
Mm. Olivia, of the two who recovered and stopped drinking, what happened to their creative process and their whole literary canon after that? Did they stop?
No. Cheever carried on writing. He wrote what I think is his best novel, Faulkner, after his recovery. And it's a novel about recovery. It's about a heroin addict in prison who manages to stop. As for Carver, a lot of his really greatest work, I think, comes in that 10 years of sobriety he had before he died of lung cancer. They both died of cancer, in fact. And Raymond Carver lived out west. He lived in Port Angeles. And he wrote some really beautiful poems and a great many stories that seem filled with a kind of redemption that I think you don't get in his early work and that is clearly very hard-earned. So he was definitely still creatively alive, creatively stimulated, and he talks about his recovery. He says all the time, I'm so grateful that I got what he called a second life. And I think that's really a wonderful thing.
That's nice. And in your own family and then in your own writing, I mean, how has the experience with alcoholism, and I don't know if you've personally struggled with drinking, but how has it shaped your creativity and the influence on your writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I think it was very difficult for my family. It was something that we didn't talk about for a long time. I think it made me interested in how people work and hopefully more compassionate than I would have been otherwise. That's a hard question to answer, really. It's hard to tell what sort of good comes from that sort of early damage, but I think it definitely informs me as a writer. I find it hard to put my finger on how, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, sort of going back to this trip, I was in Havana, Cuba, and, you know, in the guidebook, it said something like, oh, if you want to see, you know, the bar in this city that Hemingway, you know, got obliterated in, go to 4th Street or whatever. People go to these bars, and it's as though we want to gain some insight to the experience of how it was to experience certain vistas and perspectives through the eyes of someone like Ernest Hemingway. And the whole concept is quite interesting. You know, how to go to the Running of the Bulls, for example, in Pamplona and do it like Ernest Hemingway did. There's a romantic notion.
Yeah, yeah. And it was that romantic idea and that sort of myth that I really wanted to chip away at, because we're not thinking, hey, I want to go to the bar where he was sick and think about that, are we? We're like, I want to see him being glamorous and witty. And, you know, there's a sort of idea that he was some heroic drinker, I think, which really, that might have been true at one point in his 30s, but when you pick him up in later life when he's paranoid and depressed and angry and fighting with his friends and fighting with his wife, it's not anywhere near so attractive. And I just felt like that story is really important to tell as well, because, you know, much as I like a pretty bar as much as anyone, but there's something very dangerous, I think, about the glamorizing of drinking in that sort of way.
Yeah, that's a slippery slope. I mean, people can't connect with Hemingway or these other writers by going and writing necessarily. Very few people can do that and kind of relate to them. But anybody can go pull up a bar stool at the bar that Hemingway, you know, threw back some drinks and feel like they're connecting with him in that way. But that is a slippery slope.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really slippery slope, and where it ended for him is just a very sad place, I think.
Well, your book has been described as a great literary analysis, a memoir. It's also a travelogue. It's like a road trip that you're taking along with some of these great writers. And so it provides interest in a variety of mediums, really. So congratulations on achieving that.
Thank you. That side of it was very important. I thought the travel side was really important, to just see where they were from and how that, you know, the country of America has informed their lives and their work.
Yes, absolutely. Well, The Trip to Echo Spring is the book. And Olivia Lang, congratulations again. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye. And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Looking to jazz up your Sunday evenings? Well, listen to the Utah Jazz 180 with me, Mitch Echo, every Sunday at 6:06 after NPR News for the latest Utah jazz news and information.
For adventurers on a budget, the Utah Olympic Park offers a host of activities at no charge. Admission and parking are always free. Start with a tour of the Alfingen Ski Museum and the Eccles 2002 Winter Games Museums. Best of all, come support athletes from all over the world who train at the park. Open daily from 10 to 6. Details at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance came to life when the Stop Ski Link movement gained steam in opposition to that link that would disturb the pristine backcountry and watershed between Canyons Resort and Solitude Ski Resort. While legislation at the state level seems certain to facilitate that link, several issues have now really deemed Ski Link a non-issue, but one of those was the lease takeover of Canyons by Vail Resorts, not really interested in expanding in that direction, and the other was this strong opposition to Ski Link. With a successful lobby by Save Our Canyons against it, and also this growing group of backcountry activists who have now coalesced to advocate the preservation of wild spaces along the Wasatch Mountains and its canyons. Now here to represent the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance, joining us in the studio is Tom Daigle. And good morning to you, Tom.
Hi. Thanks, Lynn. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. And we've spoken to you once before. And, you know, I imagine that, well, gosh, when did the Stop Ski Link thing really, or the Ski Link legislation really halt? I'm thinking it was 6 months ago or so.
Yeah, it was about 6 months ago.
Okay. So obviously you formed, the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance has formed, and you're probably moving in other directions now.
Well, basically the idea was that we formed after the Stop Ski Link effort was successful, after the Ski Link was abandoned. But we saw that there was an opportunity for ski resorts to continue to expand, and therefore an opportunity for backcountry skiers to sort of unite and create a voice to preserve the opportunities for backcountry human-powered backcountry enthusiasts in the Wasatch. So there will continue to be threats, and we just want to be organized and ready to be there when that happens.
So, Tom, are you different from Save Our Canyons because your focus is more narrow, or your membership is all backcountry skiers and you're not dealing with transportation and watershed, or are you? Do you overlap with Save Our Canyons?
That's a great question. We talk to Save Our Canyons quite a bit. We work with them closely. In fact, the Stop Ski Link program, there was a big fundraiser to raise money specifically for Save Our Canyons. Save Our Canyons is a great organization. They've been around for a long time. They have excellent people. They have a lot of respect in the both the legislative community here and the environmental community. We felt that there was an opportunity for a winter human-powered specific organization that really had a laser focus on backcountry winter use. Save Our Canyons is a relatively small organization, despite they're able to have a huge effect considering how small they are, but they're spread pretty thin. And so we want to kind of keep a really tight focus on the wintertime human-powered use.
So is your organization bigger than Save Our Canyons? By membership or people who would affiliate with the group with a more narrow focus, where their organization is smaller with a more broad focus?
That's a good question. I don't know what their numbers are. We are at about 1,000 members right now without very much really a huge effort. So I'm sure that Save Our Canyons is a larger constituency than that. So we want to be able to combine our numbers and our efforts to provide a really, you know, a strong constituency that when they do propose ski resort expansion, we want to be able to be there and have the numbers combined with Save Our Canyons and Wasatch Backcountry Alliance to sort of thwart those efforts.
And so you're really looking at ski resort expansion. That's how you frame.
That's essentially what we are trying to avoid.
And so give us the sort of synopsis of your argument, why you want to preserve those pristine areas between between resorts. I think your argument is that we have enough resorts and the Wasatch is so fragile.
That's essentially, that is a great synopsis of it. Basically, Salt Lake City and the Wasatch Back together have, I think, nine resorts here, eight world-class resorts that have actually a skier density that's quite a bit lower than our arch rival, Colorado. And, you know, Solitude sort of lives up to its name. They tout how, you know, there's very few people there. And the ski experience really is of the highest quality as it is. And we don't really feel like, in order for the ski resorts to continue to be successful, that they need to necessarily expand their skiable acreage.
Right. So might a ski resort, I mean, if you're in the marketing department for a ski resort and you need to take a new message each year out to your public, out to your user groups, a lot of times it is a message of expansion, I guess, if I come to think about it. But might the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance, you know, provide those ski resorts with, you know, other ideas for expansion, which may be expanding snowmaking or replacing old chairs with high speed chairs?
Sure. That, you know, that's been sort of the ski resort model for a long time, is to every year expand their acreage and then advertise that in the fall in an effort to get people to book trips for that coming season. That model is great, but with skier numbers sort of going down and backcountry skier numbers rising dramatically, it's the only growth area in the industry right now. We feel like that there's an opportunity for people to, for the industry to look more to backcountry skiers as an opportunity rather than a liability for the ski resorts.
Tom, is all ski resort expansion bad?
That's a great question, and I think that the answer is not necessarily.
Okay, but it sounded like you had sort of, your group has drawn a line, and you're saying no more ski resort expansion, acreage expansion.
Beyond their existing boundaries.
Beyond existing boundaries.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. A few years ago, a group called Envision Utah did a really comprehensive polling process down in the Salt Lake Valley and up here, getting people's opinions about ski resorts and recreation in the Central Wasatch. And 90% of the people polled said they did not favor any ski resort expansion. And it's also part of the National Forest Service plan for the Central Wasatch, which incidentally is already the highest use density in the national forest in the country.
Let me ask you a question that's a little wonkish, but would linking the three resorts in the Park City area, Canyons, Park City Mount Resort, and Deer Valley, via chairlift, gondola, tram to their bases or somewhere in their terrain, would that qualify as expansion of their terrain within their – I mean, how would you frame that? Is that expansion beyond their boundaries, or is that connecting their boundaries, or how does that fit into what you guys are looking at?
That's a great question, and I'm not as quite as familiar with that terrain, but it seems like that the resorts already are practically abutted against each
other.
They are. Yeah. So it would seem to me that it would be a if indeed Ski Utah wanted to make a big marketing push, that if they could get those three resorts to work together to be able to have one sort of, quote, mega resort on a European-style basis, which I think is one of the goals of Ski Utah and the ski industry in America anyway, that would be a viable opportunity. And it wouldn't really take away any terrain because, like I said, it seems like they're abutting each other as it is anyway.
Yeah, so that backcountry terrain is already impacted,
right?
Wouldn't create new impacts on that. You already have housing developments up in some of what used to be 20 years ago considered backcountry terrain. That battle's been fought. And
indeed. Now, the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance really is focusing more on over the major ridges into the drainages, essentially from Little Cottonwood to Big Cottonwood to Parley's to the Parley's side.
Well, and it's interesting when Vail Resorts came in and bought the lease for operation of Canyons Resort, that's exactly what they said. Why should we go over this ridgeline when we have three resorts yet to be hooked up as one on this side? And I think as a backcountry enthusiast or skier or snowboarder, you never go up from this side anyway. I mean, most everyone looking for backcountry goes around to one of the canyons, right?
Yes, I think.
Unless you live in Summit Park.
Right. I think that Summit Park is a little bit different, and I am not quite as familiar with Park City, but it would seem to be fairly problematic to try and get to, say, Little Cottonwood from here without driving down and around.
Yeah. I'm wondering, Tom, if you have looked into, you know, for example, Vail Resorts owns that Trois Vallées in France, and I think it's made up of 8 different resorts that are all linked. Have you looked into any studies about, you know, these huge mega resorts in Europe? What happens to their watershed? What happens to their skier density?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we haven't really gotten quite that far yet. So it's a great question, and I think that it'd be something worth looking at.
Well, that's the kind of thing that this group in the study that's going on right now, which is called Wasatch Summit, mm-hmm. and Save Our Canyons has a seat at that table as a stakeholder group.
Right. And Wasatch Backcountry Alliance does as well.
Excellent. I was going to ask you if you had a seat at that table. So that's kind of the comprehensive view with all those different moving parts that they're looking at and will be studying over the course of the next couple of years.
Right. There's really, I think you're getting at what is sort of one of the fundamental differences is you can look at it as a transportation option, or are we linking ski resorts? And I think that given the growth that's been happening and projected to happen in both the Salt Lake Valley and the Wasatch Back, that having transportation options, new transportation options between the three major canyons is an important thing to address and really have a visionary future of. That does not necessarily mean connecting the resorts. Because if you think about it, you know, a resort usually runs from 9:30 to 4:00. And, you know, if you want transportation, if you ski all day at Snowbird, you want to have a drink at there and you want to get back over to Park City at 7:00, you can't do it. And if you don't have the money to get over there, you know, you can't do that either.
Well, you can do it, but you have to do it in a car, some sort of vehicle. So the vision is to give people an option that does not necessitate a car.
Right.
A seamless, exciting, fun option that's carless.
Right. And ideally doesn't have lifts going over the ridgelines.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's sort of fundamentally where we're at. I mean, there's lots of different ways. There's Guardsman, which has now been somewhat paved. And there are, as we mentioned last time, there's lots of tunnels, old mining tunnels that go underneath.
Right.
They're talking about a train. You know, there are trains going up the two, you know, Little Cottonwood, Big Cottonwood canyons. So there are ways to do this without necessarily ski resort expansion per se.
Okay. And we ought to mention that within the Wasatch Summit, I mean, there are all these ideas flowing around about tunnels and trains and this, but it's very preliminary at this point still. I mean, literally that group has just been formed. The stakeholders have been named within the last couple months. And because it is such a comprehensive look at the Wasatch, I think that's why it's taking such a long time to get going.
Well, yeah, they're in what they call the scoping phase, which hasn't even begun the study phase. So there's a long way to go. But it's part of the visioning, you know, which is it's a very interesting group.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really big deal. And you know, the whole watershed thing is really complicates the issues a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about Europe, I'm not sure if they have that same complicating issue. And it's a lot different than Colorado, which I think doesn't have this, you know, the Vail, the I-70 corridor. Those guys don't have the same watershed issues that we have.
Right. Okay. So if you become a member of Wasatch Backcountry Alliance, first of all, you just go to wasatchbackcountryalliance.org to sign up.
Yep.
What does a member do get?
A great question. At this point, we've just started, and you basically go to the site, you sign up, you get a confirmation email, and then that basically puts you on a list, and we promise we won't bug you. Other than we'll kind of want to keep you informed of what's going on. In the Wasatch. We haven't actually started sending out emails yet. We have been keeping our Facebook page pretty well updated. We update that weekly. And we'll eventually use that list of our members to when we need to coalesce and get a lot of movement, feedback, advocacy, we'll use that list and basically create the community.
Okay. Sounds great. Tom Daigle with the Wasatch Backcountry Alliance. Thanks for coming in today.
Great. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the opportunity.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Cindy Chupak. She's the New York Times bestselling author of the Between Boyfriends book. And now The Longest Date. Turns out she got married and she's going to tell us all about it.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Hi, this is Catherine Simos, Vice President and Branch Manager at Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, a proud supporter of KPCW. We understand the importance of local banking. We offer banking products from checking and savings accounts to business lending. Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch is located at 1225 Deer Valley Drive or online at grandvalleybank.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, Tim Henney. Well, Cindy Chupak is the New York Times bestselling author of the Between Boyfriends book. Now, as she's moved along in her life and met perhaps Prince Charming in disguise as the bad boy that you love to love, she explores the happy, hilarious, and sometimes tragic life in The Longest Date. And that's the title of her new book, The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. Chupak is a writer for Modern Family and Sex in the City. In fact, she's won 3 Golden Globes and 2 Emmys for her work on those shows. And we're delighted to be joined by her. And good morning to you, Cindy. Cindy, do we have you there?
Hi, how are you?
We're well. Cindy, you are such an accomplished writer. Between Modern Family, which is, I have to say, my very favorite series on TV, and then, of course, Sex in the City. Just wondering, mostly, now you've come out with this book, and we were talking about how difficult it must be to adapt. You know, you have, if you're screenwriting, you have these wonderful actors. I mean, Modern Family, wow, what great actors, bringing your story to life and all your words. How difficult is it to make the transition to just, it's just your story?
It's kind of been, the transition would be the other way for me, because I studied journalism and I was trying to do hard news and I wasn't great at that, and I kind of wanted to inject myself into it a little more, and I found my way to that kind of writing, which was essays. And and then I think I had written one that a producer saw and encouraged me to think about sitcom writing. So I learned how to kind of create my own stories, especially on a show like Everybody Loves Raymond and Modern Family and Sex and the City, and take kind of a kernel of truth from my own stories, or the whole story, whole hog, and put it into an episode. And that was very gratifying, because you could rewrite, embellish, you know, come up with a better ending than actually happened, or a better retort. And so it's been really fun to do that way, and you can also sort of hide behind the fictional characters and, you know, oh, it happened to someone else on staff or something. So I learned how to put my experiences into fiction, but to write as myself in the first person is still really comfortable to me, and I've continued to do kind of storytelling, the moth type things, and I love first-person stories and hearing people tell first-person stories. So to me, that's a really comfortable way to write, and takes a little less work than trying to figure out how to adapt it.
Cindy, let's talk about one of the characters in your story, and that's your husband, Ian. He seems to get an awful lot of credit. You give him credit in the credits for the book. You acknowledge the role that he played. He also, you know, plays a prominent, well, not just prominent, but he's kind of one of the central themes through the entire story and all of your essays. And he's also, you call him a bad boy. I mean, who is this guy, Ian?
He is the man I married. And yeah, when I first met him, he was you know, had all the signs of someone you should stay away from. And I'd been looking for a long time for, you know, I'd been single a long time. I was writing Sex and the City. I knew enough to know, like, okay, this guy is trouble. He had tattoos and a motorcycle, and he, you know, drank a lot, and he just didn't like his job, and, you know, just told me he would break my heart. And so I told my friends, make sure I don't fall for this guy. And then I did, but also Ian just kept turning out to be better than I expected. And it was funny because so many men I dated, I projected, this is the one, and, you know, they would disappoint me. Whereas Ian, I'm sure he wasn't the one. And then he kept surprising me, and I think himself, with how, you know, how much he really was, you know, able to commit and was romantic deep down and, you know, was a good partner.
So that's kind of the fairy tale ending for the bad boy, but because
yeah,
it turns out he's a good
that.
Boy. I know. And we so would.
And who knows? Maybe it's not the end, you know? Yeah. Someday we may look back and go, ah.
No, we have great confidence. We have great confidence in Ian. All the people you've talked to, all the characters that you've written for, why is it, do you think, we as women are often attracted to the bad boy instead of the nice and normal boy?
I think there's something, you know, it's part of our flaw. But it's so hard to get. You feel like it's a little bit more of a accomplishment when a bad boy sets his sights on you, if he keeps his sights on you. And it's manly. I mean, in my book, I talk about my first marriage was to someone who realized he was gay. So
right.
I guess maybe a guy who rode a motorcycle and had tattoos was a bad boy seemed like a good antidote to that. I don't know. And he, I know I just glossed over that, but on my website at CindyShubeck.com, I've got the story of that first marriage, and it's in my book, too. And, yeah, that was why I was single for so long, because that was an early 20s marriage. And then I met Ian. So, anyway, I think it's partly the, you know, the allure of the guy that it seems hard to get and seems elusive and, you know.
Yeah.
He's sexy.
Darn it.
So, Cindy, you said something.
That doesn't mean a bad boy can't also be a nice guy. I mean, ideally, they're both, a little bit of both.
Yeah, right.
So, Cindy, you said something just a second ago about projecting a story about relationship into the future. And Ian didn't bring any of that. He didn't bring a projection. He didn't bring expectations. And you just let it unfold. Is that a theme in your essays about this, you know, the longest date? It's a progression of marriage from the initial meeting of the bad boy with no expectations to being the man of your dreams.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there was a lot about marriage that surprised me. And what I feel is that, you know, there was so much, I did a lot of writing about dating. There's a lot out there about dating. The quest seems like such a noble quest to try to find love. I mean, I love writing about that. And then it felt like you get married and you've made your bed, now lie in it. Like, you don't really know how to talk about it anymore because it feels a little disloyal to talk about with other people or something. And if you have problems, you're worried, you know, does this mean, is this a big problem? And I don't know, I just wanted to find a way to talk about it that felt like the way I'd written about everything else and, you know, show that it wasn't all easy and, you know, some of it was actually difficult and the adjustments, just the little growing pains of being your own person and having your own space and then sharing that space and deciding how you feel about house guests and traveling and stuff and dogs, you want a dog and, you know, just everything that seems kind of mundane. I thought if I could actually write the truth about what that growing pain is like, and even I found I was a terrible nurturer. Like, I don't really like when he's sick. I don't like taking care of when he's sick. I mean, if he was really sick, I would, but just a cold, don't find that attractive, really. Being honest about how I felt about making more money, certain things that I thought, like, maybe this is going to be very unappealing side of me to reveal, but yeah. If I can figure out how to talk about it honestly and with humor, maybe it will be a relief for other women to hear somebody say this and feel like maybe I feel the same.
Well, you know, it's interesting, I think, Cindy, that a lot of people say about marriage, oh, you have to have a good sense of humor. But I'm wondering for you, if it was that humor that made you feel like, oh, you know, this isn't drudgery, this isn't a life sentence, that you could overcome and surmount some of those big, heavy things.
Yeah, I think not just my own, but knowing that I could laugh about things with Ian or talk about things with him. I mean, the only times I've been genuinely worried about if our marriage would last would be when we've had, and it's been very infrequently that we've just had an impasse we can't seem to talk about, or like he can't seem to hear me and I can't seem to hear him. And I'm all for marriage counseling, not to just go at the very end when you feel like there's no solution, but sometimes when you're just at an impasse, you need to be more, or just maybe have a friend who could be an impartial. But the only times I've been really worried is when I feel like he just can't hear me and I can't hear him. It doesn't happen often. And so I feel like communicating and being able to laugh about things and just be honest about it is half the battle, because I know sometimes people just like get to suffer alone and this is just how it's going to be, and that's not good.
Cindy, it seems like your essays and what you're saying is you're taking a different view and perspective, looking around this central issue or maybe issues and trying to shine a light on it and expose it and let people know that they're not the only one that struggle with these challenges. Is there, from looking at all at whatever it is, what we call marriage, from all these different perspectives, is there a or are there a couple of major theme takeaways for people in your book that you were trying to convey?
Well, I think one of the big ones was our you know, the baby quest. I think before I went through it, when I heard someone was trying to have a baby, I would say, congratulations, you know, and now I realize that can be a really trying time for a couple and for a marriage when you're ready to have a baby and you're having trouble. Either you did what I did, where you got married very late, much later in life, or for whatever reason, if you're going plan A to B to C to D to E, those transitions, whether you're able to navigate them together as a couple or whether you're able to talk about it with girlfriends, can be a very lonely and challenging time in a marriage. So one thing I wanted to just say is, you know, you're not alone. Mm-hmm. A lot of women go through this. These feelings you're having are normal. And, you know, don't be afraid to talk about these things with your friends or with some people you love and trust and with each other, with your, you know, spouse. And just know that you're going to get through it one way or the other. But, you know, it's not easy. So that was a big thing I wanted to accomplish, was just to give some comfort and humor and levity and honesty about that, what that quest is. And the other thing was to do the same for marriage, to just say it's okay to have these feelings. You don't always have to be, you know, I wrote a piece for the New York Times, and the first line was, you know, in any marriage, even the best marriage, there will come a time when you will wonder why the hell you married this person. And one of the first comments on the New York Times site was, I've never wondered that about my spouse, and we've been married all these years. And I feel like there's a knee-jerk kind of, what? I would never feel anything but love. And I don't think that serves anyone. Maybe that's true, and maybe, you know, my marriage isn't as great as other people's. I don't know, but it doesn't necessarily serve to just put only a rosy face on this thing. And it doesn't serve to put only a negative face on it. So I just wanted to do something in between and be let people feel free to talk about both sides.
Yeah, well, that really is the most honest, isn't it? You know, part humor, part, oh my goodness, what have I gotten myself into? It's kind of the human
right,
condition.
And then also just seeing that you get through it, you know, that you might have those moments, those really horrible moments where you're like, what have I done? And I cannot stand another minute with you. And then you get through it. And I think that's important to see too.
Right. So I just have to know before we let you go, Cindy, after you wrote the Between Boyfriends book, which was a bestseller, and, you know, after you wrote this one, The Longest Date, Life as a Wife, how did you end up, you know, what was the sum total of your feeling looking back at the book and your life situation? And, you know, did you feel better as that single person? Do you feel better as the married person?
Well, it's funny. I don't think I realized till I got done writing this book what the journey of me in this book is. And I think I sort of come off, and I guess I was, a bit of a curmudgeon. You know, as much as I thought it was really fun, and I think I'm fun, but I was a little bit like, I didn't talk to my neighbors, didn't really want to be bothered. Like, I was observing the world, but not necessarily part of the world. So I had my own house that I kept very neat. So having this guy move in, and then his stuff move in, and then he talked me into St. Bernard that moved in and had hair, and even though I lived at the beach, I never had sand in my house, and then having a child, and then, you know, just everything got messier, and I think that's life. That's kind of what I realized is, you know, it's all part of this journey. Like, I still see it as this continuum from when I was dating to becoming really a fully formed person who liked my life but hadn't figured out how someone else was going to fit into it. And then figuring out how to fit someone in and fit in just the messiness of life. But that all made me feel much more connected to everyone, like single, married, parents, kind of everybody. I feel now I've got a much fuller perspective of more appreciation for my parents, my mom. I mean, yeah. Just sort of coming around to seeing from a more global perspective what everybody goes through.
That's nice. And it's nice, again, that you've done it with humor. Cindy Shupak is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Between Boyfriends book. She's now back with this book, The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. And Cindy, best of luck to you with this book and your married life. And
it's... Thank you. I hope it never becomes ironic, but we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. And give our best to Ian, if you would.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot, Cindy. Again, Cindy Shupak, the author of The Longest Date, Life as a Wife. That was great.
That's a long date.
That's a long date. Well, less long for some.
Sometimes it can be a long date. Yeah.
Sometimes it can feel really long. All right, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll thank our underwriters.
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, the Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Park Meadows Country Club, San Francisco Design, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame, and Grand Valley Bank.
And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we make promises all the time. We just don't keep them.
Is any of the show going to air?
None. None. I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear things that none of us ever imagined saying on the radio. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
Executive Chef Chris Sheehan from Park Meadows Country Club here, supporting KPCW. We offer regionally inspired cuisine such as pine nut crusted filet of sole for dining inside or outside. Our dining venues are also ready for any occasion, and golf, social, and dining memberships are also available. 649-2460 or on the web at parkmeadowscc.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com, VaultHomeLoans.com, Purchase and Refinance Mortgages, Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Join us for Cool Science Radio, Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m., only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
I'm Scott Chester with the Park City High School Booster Club. Keep in touch with all things minors with our weekly Minor Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday during morning news with Leslie Thatcher and in the afternoon on the Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things minors every Monday.
Brought to you by UPS Stores, Elliott Work Group, and Todd Wakefield, Attorney at Law.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Want to remind you to tune in to Cool Science Radio tomorrow at 9 a.m. Let's see, we'll be speaking about lizards and their brains and how we've come to this this acknowledgement of the reptilian brain and what that means. We'll also be talking about Discover Magazine's 100 Top Stories of 2013.